absolute that I screamed and removed the helmet. For a moment I floated in Vadim's cabin, breathing hard, wondering just what I'd experienced. The feeling of immense claustrophobia, combined with even worse agoraphobia, took long seconds to abate, like the afterchime of an awful bell. My hands trembling, although I was beginning to regain some control, I removed the experiential and examined it more closely, this time paying proper attention to the little motif near the top of the stick. It looked a lot like a maggot. I watched our approach to the rust belt through the observation window in Vadim's cabin. I knew something of what lay ahead now. Shortly after I tried the disturbing experiential, while I was still reeling from its effects, in fact, the console had chimed, announcing the arrival of a response to my earlier query. I was surprised. In my experience, such things usually happened instantaneously or not at all, and the delay served only to emphasize how disrupted the system's data networks must have been. The message, it turned out, was a standard-issue document, rather than a personally composed reply. An automated mechanism must have decided that it would answer most of my questions, an assumption that turned out to be reasonably accurate. I started reading. Dear newcomer, welcome to the Epsilon Eridani system. Despite all that has happened, we hope your stay here will be a pleasant one. For your information, we have compiled this note to explain some of the key events in our recent history. It is intended that this information will ease your transition into a culture which may be markedly different from the one you were expecting to find when you embarked at your point of origin. It is important that you realize that others have come before you. The document was long, but I quickly read the thing in its entirety, then reread it carefully, picking out the salient points which might assist me in the hunt for Rivage. I'd already been forewarned about the scale of the plague's effects, so the document's revelations were perhaps not as shocking to me as they would have been to someone freshly defrosted. But it was still chilling to see it anatomized in such a coolly detached manner, and it was easy to imagine how unsettling it must have been to someone who had come to Yellowstone in search of riches rather than blood. The mendicants had clearly elected not to spring this news on their slush puppies too quickly, and doubtless if I'd stayed in Idlewild a little longer, they would have begun to break it to me gently. But perhaps the document was right. There were some truths it was best to deal with as quickly as possible, no matter how repugnant that truth might have been. I wondered how long it would take me to adjust to it, or if I'd be one of the unfortunate few who never quite made the transition. Perhaps, I thought, they were actually the sane ones. Through the window, the larger Rust Belt habitats had begun to assume definite shapes, rather than just being indistinct orbiting flecks. I tried to imagine what it would have looked like 7 years ago, in the last days before the plague. There'd been 10,000 habitats in the Glitter Band, each as opulent and faceted as a chandelier, each distinguished from its neighbors by some wild architectural flourish that had far less to do with the practicalities of structural design than it had with aesthetics and prestige. They'd circled Yellowstone in low orbit, almost nose to tail, each vast and stately construct maintaining polite distance from those ahead and behind it with tiny puffs of correcting thrust. A constant flow of commerce had shuffled between the habitats along narrow traffic lanes, so that from a distance the habitats themselves looked as if they were entwined in tinsel-like filaments of light. Depending on the ever-shifting spectrum of allegiances and feuds, the habitats either communicated with each other via looms of quantum-encrypted laser light, or maintained sullen silences. Such silences were not